About a week ago, my brother, John, handed me an article written by Charles Darwin explaining why he had lost his faith in God. And I, of course, have mountains of emails and other things to read, but I put that next to my chair, wanting to read it, but the days went by and so on, and I just couldn't pause to care too much about Charles Darwin and his infidelities, spiritual infidelity. But I picked it up the other day, and I was reading his flimsy, specious arguments, and then I came to another article following it, which was stapled in with the first one. So I started reading that, and it sounded like a very intelligent article by some creationist scientist, PhD, who had broad worldview and thoroughly understood not only issues of science, but issues of the great issues of our time. And I found it quite captivating. It sounded like a very intelligent person. Mm-hmm. And just as I was getting a paragraph or two from the end, it began to dawn on me, I wonder if my brother John wrote this. And lo and behold, there his name was at the end. And I was so flabbergasted with the thoughtfulness, the erudition, the learning, the scholarship of this article that I just was determined right then we were going to use that as fodder for an interesting Bible study discussion, a symposium on the theory of evolution. And this, of course, is extremely relevant to the church because most of the evangelical churches now pay lip service to theistic evolution. So I've gathered our group together this Sunday afternoon, and many of our group are very knowledgeable creationists. We are fortunate to have a monthly forum here in the Portland area. I believe it's at Rolling Hills Church consistently, called Design Science Association. And they bring in top-flight creationist scientists and PhDs, experts, geologists, in a wonderfully informing educational program once a month. And our group always goes over there. I've been so busy I haven't been able to attend, even though I've been a staunch creationist ever since high school. But they go over there, and every month they get a huge amount of new information, very, very cutting-edge, original research and thoughtfulness here in the Portland area. As a result, I've gathered our group here together. Most of them here are in the front row, and we're going to have a symposium today. What I'm going to do, I'm going to read paragraph by paragraph from John's article, pausing to reflect it, but primarily to invite members of our group to participate and give their thoughts, unique thoughts concerning what they've learned about the fallacy of evolution. And one of the primary witnesses we have here today is Johnny Pike Jr. There's two John Pikes here, John and his son Johnny, who is a off and on lab instructor at Warner Pacific College, teaching biology lab. So he has a background in not only creation science, but biology on a much higher level than most of us have. So having said that, I'll begin this symposium. I should mention that we are putting up this discussion tonight at truthtellers.org, as well as sending it out to our thousands of subscribers. And the article by Darwin will be linked with this article right in my editor's note. Even in the first line, you can link to Darwin's article and thoroughly acquaint yourself with his lame reasons for giving up faith in God. I think some of our audience would like to read that article to know exactly what John is responding to. Hello, Charles. I have recently read your autobiographical thoughts concerning why you abandoned faith in God. I have the distinct advantage to live 150 years in your future and have some observations about your conclusions. I wish to first rephrase your statements concerning miracles. Quote, the more we know about the fixed laws of nature, the more miraculous they become. That's Darwin's statement. John says, modern discoveries of my time reveal a biological complexity of which you never dreamed. You know nothing of the cell's workings or the brain's intricate circuitry. In fact, you knew nothing of electricity. We now observe an irreducible complexity which abounds in the natural world. The features of complex organisms must all simultaneously exist before the organism can be productive. This, of course, compromises your belief that chance mutations over long periods of time could create complex function. This is a very interesting first paragraph. What it shows is that Darwin was really did not have enough information to make bold pronouncements about human or the origins of life or the origins of species, did he? He didn't have anything compared to us, the magnitude of scientific data, especially as John is saying here about the cell, the brain chemistry, all of this kind of higher organic chemistry and so on, genetics, etc., which we are able to work with today. And of course, there are outstanding creationist scientists who are absolutely experts, confounding the evolutionists concerning some of these presumptions and givens that are taken for granted by the evolutionists, that matter is capable of organizing itself spontaneously in contradiction to the laws of physics. What do you say, Johnny Jr., about this level of complexity?
I would say that my dad is correct in stating the fact that Darwin did not have a understanding at all like we do concerning the basic cell of life, and in his time he was happily convinced that it was probably just a little blob of protoplasm or something that easily came into existence, and from that point he developed his theory. But his whole theory is based on that being in existence, the cell to begin with. But the cell, as we have determined since his time, is more complex than the infrastructure of a major city.
Yes,
and
one cell.
Is, yes, correct. That
one cell is more complex than Los Angeles.
Yeah, and so that is a crucial part that he just happened to wave off. And build from there, but we are evolutionary theory still, it cannot satisfactorily explain how that cell even got here.
Yes. Yeah, it's amazing. You know, what's the date on Gregor Mendel? When did Gregor Mendel come on the scene with genetics? I think he was more like in the 1890s, later than Darwin, but the science of genetics was unknown in scientific terms. Of course, ever since the dawn of civilization, agriculturalists have been breeding various plants. In fact, I was down at on my day off the other day, and I looked down, and here was a wild onion growing next to me, a little tiny plant, about 2 inches high, a little wild onion. So I picked it up, and I dusted it off, and I had a crunch. It was an onion. Okay, well, thousands of years ago, people discovered that, and they said, hey, let's take some of these, and maybe we can, when they seed in the fall, let's take these and plant them near our village or whatever, and they started gradually developing the bigger ones, the stronger ones, the hotter ones, and so on, and develop onions and so on. Well, that's kind of a genetics, isn't it? Kind of a husbandry of living things. What Darwin was really in the dark about was this staggering multiplicity of wonders that goes into making life. For example, now, does anybody in the scientific world, have they even figured out the source of cellular differentiation, why we grow to the proportions we do, and then some mechanism says stop? Now, I'm not talking about DNA, I'm not talking about RNA, because they are kind of the messengers. They are the errand boys for some greater complexity and greater wisdom in every living thing. And this source of cellular differentiation has always intrigued me, and of course, I'm sure if a scientist explained it to me, I wouldn't understand it. But there is complex. I mean, you were telling us the other day about mitochondria and the cell and so on, and the fantastic complexity that is involved in just operating the simplest component of physiology. Okay, another point here, irreducible complexity. Oh, John, yes, excuse me.
When I wrote this letter, I had just finished reading this chapter in Charles Darwin's autobiography, which I believe was published after his death. This original chapter, titled Religious Belief, I believe was not included in that original publication, but has been included in subsequent publications. In it, Darwin made some incredible statements that incriminated him. There had been some controversy as to whether Darwin repented before on his deathbed, but after you read his statements, you understand that he had burned his bridges behind him, and he had no religious faith. And I just wanted to read just a couple statements here that kind of give us the sense of this chapter. Darwin says, "But I had gradually come by this time to see that the Old Testament, from its manifestly false history of the world, with the Tower of Babel, the rainbow as a sign, etc., etc., and from its attributing to God the feelings of a revengeful tyrant, was no more to be trusted than the sacred books of the Hindus or the beliefs of any barbarian." He's making statements which we are very familiar today. We've heard them from Hawkins and Gould, and so he was kind of the grandfather of the cynic.
Yes.
And they have a wonderful heritage in repeating Darwin's final gasps of disbelief. He says, "By further reflecting that the clearest evidence would be requisite to make any sane man believe in the miracles by which Christianity is supported, that the more we know of the fixed laws of nature, the more incredible do miracles become, that the men at that time were ignorant and credulous to a degree almost incomprehensible by us. I gradually came to disbelieve in Christianity as a divine revelation." So my rephrasing of his observation that because of the fixed laws of nature, miracles are too incredible to believe, I had to rephrase that and say, the more we know about the fixed laws of nature, the more miraculous they become.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So let's talk about irreducible complexity you mentioned here. So many organs and organisms could not exist according to the model of evolution in which a primitive organism gradually acquires certain rudimentary structures, and then that rudimentary structure develops, adapts, is modified to become something as marvelous as an ear or an eye or a feather or whatever. For example, when I was studying comparative vertebrate anatomy in college, we learned about the amphioxus, which is a very primitive backboned chordate, and it has light-sensitive pigment on the back of its little body. And they were telling us at Portland State University at that time that this light-sensitive pigment was the beginning of the eye. And then you go up the phylogenetic tree a little bit to the lamprey eel, which we have swimming in our creeks here in the fall here in Oregon. The lamprey eel has a fully developed eye, which is the next stage up from it's the amphioxus and then up to the lamprey eel. Fully developed eye. It has the lens, it has pupil, it has retina, it has the sclera, it has the everything we have. Suddenly, out of, talk about lack of connecting links. Here the evolutionists go from light-sensitive pigment to a fully functional eye, such as we do, optic nerve, everything. Now, here's a double problem for the evolutionist, and that is that completely on a different limb of the evolutionary tree, you have the mollusks, like the octopus, the squid, even the clam, and so on, and they've also got lensed eyes. In fact, the eyes of a squid are absolutely incredible. They're as cute as ours for finding little things to go after. And so they developed a lensed eye out of nowhere on their own too. Okay? Well, this is what John is talking about here, the mystery, quote-unquote mystery for the evolutionists, of irreducible complexity in the sense that something can't exist with all of its interconnecting parts like an eye, because there is no transition leading up to that. In fact, Darwin said of the lensed eye, he said, that damned lensed eye, because there were no observable transition forms in nature leading up to that irreducibly complex, almost photographic instrument we are blessed with called eyes. Now, there are other organs that are in this category of irreducible complexity. They had to have been created intact, ready to go, functioning, with a number of organs working simultaneously at the same time. They could not have evolved in a long, tedious process of adding new adaptations. For example, the ear. You have the malus, the incus, the stapes. You have all of these interconnecting marvels in the vertebrate ear. Well, back when I was studying this in college, I asked my professor, I said, where did the ear come from? And he said, well, there's an article in the archives here at Portland State about the evolution of the ear. So I went and I looked up that article. And they said that millions and millions of years ago, the jawbone of some primitive crocodile or something, going from amphibious stage, the part of the jawbone migrated up and started wobbling up here, and started these bones drifted up and started articulating and making vibrations, and that was the beginning of the ear. Okay, well, I don't think that primitive creature really heard too much out of his jawbone articulating. It was a hyomandibular bone or something like that. Anyway, I asked my professor, I said, why do you believe evolution when everything is so conjectural, especially these organs like the eye? I said, where did the eye come from? You have a minimum of 10 organs and functions, like a camera, working in the eye in concert. And he says, if you went to graduate school and you got your PhD, you could put out your own theory about where the eye came from, and it'd be just as good as anybody else's, he said. Because nobody knows where the eye comes from, he said. All we know, he said, is that it happened. It happened. And then he went on to say, he said, you can believe in creation, you can believe, or I can believe in evolution. He says, it doesn't make too much difference, he said, because, he says, the evidence is what you want to make out of it. And he says, down in there to Grand Canyon, he says, I did a doctoral thesis on Grand Canyon or something. And he said, everything is all topsy-turvy, all chaotic. He said, this is nonsense that there's some kind of even strata leading us up and taking us back million by million years into the past. He said, everything is chaotic. He says, in the end result, you believe what you want to believe. That's pretty much what he told me. Now, what I didn't tell him, which I wish I would have told him, is I wanted to say to him, hey, if you're wrong, and this is a matter of subjective belief, God Almighty is going to be awfully mad at you when you die. He is going to be furious with you. Don't you know that? And this guy was a Texas Bible Belt professor. I said, I wish I said, God is going to be so angry at you because you have spent your whole life stripping him of all the glory he deserves for creation. If you're wrong, he is going to be so angry at you because you have absolutely deprived him of the glory and the credit that every artist or every engineer would at least want for the wonderful works that he had made. Some of the other examples of irreducible complexity which I discovered are things like the feathers. Feathers? I asked the same professor, I said, how did feathers evolve? We were studying the different types of scales, the placoid scales, seismoid scales, I think it is. Various types of scales when we were studying reptiles. And I said, is there any evidence that the feather, which is a marvel of complexity? I picked up a vulture feather down at the river a while ago. I guess everybody knows now that I go down the river on my day off. And do you realize, some of it was ruffled. A huge pinion feather of a turkey vulture. And yet I could zip that like Ziploc. I could Ziploc that feather into perfect shape again because there are microscopic little, what do you call these things that... little barbs there all along that. And all you have to do is zip down like the bird's beak and it'll all come back and become airworthy again. A feather. I said, how did the feather evolve? He says, nobody knows. Oh, really? I opened a Time Life book at the bookstore the other day, and they were telling us exactly how feathers evolve. You know, these reptiles develop these little fringes that help them leap across the land and the water and so on. No, he says. He said the origins of the nearest reptilian predecessor to a bird. The scales on that reptile are on a completely different dermal level from feathers. I don't remember whether that's mesoderm or ectoderm or what kind of derm it is. He said evolutionists are baffled where feathers came from because they could not possibly have evolved from the same cells, adaptations, that the scales of a lizard have, you see. Irreducibly complex, there they are. Same goes for mammary glands. They say mammary glands with the ability to produce nutritious milk, which is so crucial in the first hours of all mammalian life. Even a platypus needs it, I believe. That milk, that super rich milk, whether it's a sperm whale calf out in the ocean or a mouse baby or whatever, or a human baby, they've got to have a gusher of rich, wholesome milk immediately after being born or they're going to die. And yet, we are told by the evolutionists that mammary glands came from sweat glands. Okay? Now, there are two types of secretion. There's apocrine secretion and merocrine secretion. I don't remember which is which. But all I know is that there is no possible way that the secretion involved in a mammary gland could possibly have come from the secretion of a sweat gland. And again, I was told the same thing by this evolutionary professor. We're baffled. You know, it's interesting, you do a little original probing, a little original questioning of these evolutionist professors, and you find out that the evolutionary emperor really has no clothes on whatever. And it's very, very fruitful. So anyway, that's my digression upon irreducible complexity, and we can find more examples of that. Yes, Johnny?
Oh, I'd just like to provide a concise definition of irreducible complexity.
Mm-hmm. Good.
And the term was coined by Dr. Behe in the late 90s, I believe. He defined an irreducibly complex system as a system consisting of multiple components, where if one of the components was malfunctioning or missing, the whole system would break down.
Yes.
And so that is his term for an irreducibly complex system. And the more and more we learn about biology and the natural world, we find these in all sorts of, in all organisms. And he gave some classic examples of the bacterial flagellum, mm-hmm. and the human eye, and the blood clotting system and all its many levels and factors. And all these systems, if you remove one component, they will fully fail.
Yes.
And so
there's no reason that a creature would hold on to any piece of the organism long enough for it to develop the other part.
Right. And so this is to describe systems that evolutionists have claimed all along, that the parts slowly accumulated, mm-hmm. and then once they were all finally there, then they all got together and started working to make this system. Or that somehow, before all the parts were there, they did some other function, but nobody knows that. It's just that's the only way they can theorize how the components slowly accumulated in order to make this system. But it is there is no evidence, no proof of any of these precursor systems that they say existed, and there would have had to have been millions of different precursor systems that would have provided these different components before we find them in the system that we find them in now. Yeah. And so it is. There are so many systems out there that there is no solution for, or evolutionary solution for them gradually coming into existence.
Well, isn't in its own way, isn't our relationship to the sun and the moon an irreducibly complex relationship? We're exactly the right distance from the sun to keep us from either frying or freezing. Without the moon, gravitational forces of the moon, the whole thing, where it's irreducibly complex. Of course, it's not living. But what about an atom? What about an atom with its dozen or so subatomic particles working to make it function? Irreducibly complex. And that's completely independent of competition and natural selection. Yes?
Well, my personal favorite example of irreducible complexity is the reproductive system. Mm-hmm. Because if you don't have all those pieces working at the same time, how is life even going to continue to make the rest of the pieces?
Yes.
It doesn't really work.
That's right.
Well, of course, all this evolutionary hype is in flat opposition to the laws of nature, laws of thermodynamics, laws of morphologies, the laws of physics, which says that there is no strange intelligence in these things which say, I'm going to be an eye someday. I'm going to make milk someday. No. The evolutionists are first to state that nature is blind. It is merely competition for sunlight, food, sex, etc., and has no long-term game plan. When we're talking about design, though, divine divine genius, we are talking about a very strong preconception of what God wanted, and he did it to perfection. Well, let's read some more here. This is very interesting. John goes on to address Charles, wherever he may be. Pretty good idea. I'm not going to judge him, though. You did and not live to see. You, Charles, did not live to see the failure of evolutionary paleontology to discover the multitude of missing links you so confidently expected. For example, ape-like bones have been found in profusion in the last 150 years, indicating a possibly greater variety of hominids in previous epochs. But enormous gaps in the supposed evolutionary record still exist between the many species you claimed descended from common ancestors. You know, it's kind of interesting when you get into fossil hunting, and I did some of that with the Oregon Museum of Science and Industry, and I had a friend in high school who was a geology fanatic, and we'd go over into the fossil-rich areas of eastern Oregon, and we'd bang away on rocks and bring out the fossils. But you know what? When you're fossil collecting, it gets a little bit boring sometimes because all the plants, all the animals are pretty well known in that age. You open up and, okay, here's a ginkgo leaf, here's a sequoia branch, here's a clam, here's a things, and even here's a fossil, maybe a fossil horse or a fossil camel or a fossil sloth or something. But the paleontologists, the fossil people, have pretty much created kind of a bestiary of all the animals living in that area at that time, and you go there and you know pretty much what you're going to find. And you know you're not going to find missing links all over the place. Missing links are very, very rare if you want to interpret them as missing links. And of course, a so-called missing link between reptiles and birds is Archaeopteryx. You know, the bird with the claws out on his wings and some of the reptilian features and so on. But even then, that's kind of a hard sell to tell me that came from a reptile, because there's a bird in Latin America right now called the Hotzin. And he has claws on his wings, and his babies hang from the branches using those claws, and he kind of flops around in the trees and is not at all a good flyer. Reminds me a lot of Archaeopteryx, which has been much touted by the evolutionists. And of course, you can find fossil horses that have three toes, four toes, two toes, and then like modern toe horses. But what is to keep God from saying, hey, I like a three-toed horse, I like a two-toed horse, and they went extinct? The argument is not there to say that they descended one from another. So this issue of the missing links, which Darwin confidently expected, is a very real one. And there are huge, huge gaps which the evolutionists blithely dismiss, saying, well, it happened. You know, these whales, all the whales once lived on land, evolutionists tell us. Mm-hmm. They say mammalian life evolved from four-footed creatures on land, and the only way for these whales to have gotten into the sea was they were once four-footed creatures on land, and then they began to kind of wallow around in the estuaries, and then they developed all these baleen plates, you know, and what took off for the high seas. Does that make any sense? There's no evidence. There's absolutely no evidence as far as the fossil record. Anybody have any comment about the problem of missing links in evolution?
So just as an example for the Archaeopteryx, what you'll tend to find is scientists will find what they want to believe as a missing link, and it will be highly touted in the journals and in the media and gain all sorts of awareness about this. And then a few weeks later, years later, it'll disappear. Yes. And what will have happened is, on many occasions, and what happened to Archaeopteryx is they actually evolutionists believe that the lower you go in the dirt, the older it is. Mm-hmm. And they actually found a fully formed bird in a lower level than Archaeopteryx. And they'll find that.
Sure.
And of course, they have other ideas about how birds came about, but that is pretty typical for the new missing links that they want to find.
Yes. Well, I believe that in previous ages, as I mentioned a little earlier, that there were probably many more hominid types than we have today. More Sasquatches and creatures like that who could very well be subhuman and yet have features a little more like a human skull. That's a possibility. And of course, if an evolutionist digs that up, he says, "Eureka, I've proved man came from an ape," but not necessarily. You know what this reminds me of? God says, because they would not receive the knowledge of the truth, he'll send them a strong delusion that they should believe a lie. And I can just see God setting up these fossils, waiting for the evolutionists to come along and be led into further confusion. Yes?
A lot of those humanoid skulls are humans. I mean, you put skin on them and they look like Aborigines in Australia. And that... But the evolutionists were so quick to say, this is not a human, this is a missing link. That's why African pygmies ended up in the zoo in New York City.
Yes.
Because they said, oh, that must be a missing link. It's not a human. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty offensive now to us today, but that's where this thinking leads you.
Yes.
But the thing is, if you watch any evolutionary nature program, you can't believe how many times they say millions and millions and millions of years, which is so much larger than the thousands of years that they will concede that we have the fully formed organisms of today. Mm-hmm. So you would expect that there would be way, way more bone fragments left over from the intermediary species, which were developing over these millions and millions of years, as opposed to finding mostly all fossils from fully formed animals today. And that's the evidence just is not there. If they're right, there should be those millions and millions of bones. And the thing I can't believe is when I read Origin of the Species, it's so clearly someone's speculation. Darwin is very, very clear about it. He says, and then I imagine that this could be the case. I speculate that this might have been what happened. Mm-hmm. It's clearly the construction of a mythology. And the thing I can't get over is that in the 200 years since then, they haven't come up with something better. I mean, come on. If you want to take God out of the picture, can't you find a smarter way to do it other than continuing to construct this elaborate fantasy which is not in any way supported by any evidence, any hard evidence?
Well, there is flying saucers.
Alien feeding the earth.
Yes, John.
It's a good point, Harmony. That was a major problem with Darwin, and he himself said exactly that. If anybody was to refute my theory, they would find that a lack of fossil evidence does not back me up. Yeah. But I fully expect the future to vindicate me.
Yes.
But the future has not vindicated his theory with regard to fossil evidences.
Yes. All right. Now, John goes off on a little different approach here. He says to Charles, "You also did not live to see the Bible vindicated. In the 20th century, archaeologists have discovered its ancient kingdoms and empires. The Old Testament is one of their foremost guides to antiquity. Man's preoccupation with towers, pyramids, and modern so-called skyscrapers certainly lends credibility to the Tower of Babel. The city of Nineveh, long denied as a myth, was found buried beneath the sands of time, its bricks clearly stamped with its biblical name." Yes. Any comments about that?
My letter was written specifically to respond to the issues that he brings forth in his chapter on religious belief. He condemns the Bible as manifestly false history of the world, and includes with that the Tower of Babel and so on. And the point that needed to be made was that since his time, tremendous archaeological discoveries have proven the Bible to be accurate and true,
yes.
And a foremost resource for the discovery of the antiquities. Mm-hmm. Revealing his refusal to have faith mm-hmm. as being unfounded.
Yes. Well, Darwin, like others of his time, was influenced by the emerging so-called higher criticism of the Bible, especially out of Germany, German rationalism, in which the Bible, not only archaeologically, but the Bible in its linguistic and textual integrity was held up for all kinds of supposedly scholarly examination and rebuttal and disbelief. There's an interesting sidelight concerning the origins of higher criticism of the Bible. Back in the time preceding the French Revolution, the secret societies, such as the Illuminati under Adam Weishaupt and other Kabbalistic, Jewish-oriented groups, were working hard to subvert Christianity in Western Europe and of course, in the whole world. And one night, during a thunderstorm, a courier, a lone horseman, was riding from one city to the other with saddlebags on his horses, and a bolt of lightning killed him and knocked him off his horses, and the police were called. And here in the saddlebags of this courier were extensive communications by Weishaupt and the Bavarian Illuminati to one another, and they were describing how that they had penetrated the German universities and had brought over most of the professors in the German universities who were the fountainhead of higher criticism of the Bible into an organized conspiracy to trash Christianity, destroy faith in Germany, and using contrived argumentation and false history and false research, these universities and the so-called higher critics were actually working with the Illuminati to destroy our faith in the Bible. Now, these people like Darwin, these people like Emerson and Thoreau and all these liberals, and even the great Methodist Church at this time of Darwin was paying lip service to the irrefutable argumentations of the higher critics, the German critics, and so on. In fact, one of the founders of one of the most important people in the early as a faculty member of one of the great seminaries of the East, Union Theological Seminary, was actually a Presbyterian professor who went to Germany, brought back a very great deal of this propaganda, which became a mainspring of Bible-doubting liberalism on the East Coast out of New York City. And the Rockefellers subsidized Union Theological Seminary, became a bastion of unbelief. And this doubt of the Bible, which came out of basically Jewish Kabbalistic roots in Germany in the 1770s and 80s, then proliferated out of the world, out throughout the world, and became respectable, intellectual, modernistic, progressive thinking regarding the Bible. And is even seeped down into Christian Bible schools and seminaries and colleges. So we can see the satanic origins of this whole thing. It's all worked together. All erupted like an evil boil at the end of the 19th centuries, in the 1770s, 80s, and 90s, and the world has never been the same since. All right, let's go on. In the very century after you said we are continually perfected by evolution, man's evil was most stunningly revealed. Unrestrained by the quote-unquote revengeful tyrant, meaning God, who would judge man for sin, totalitarian states and dictators sprang up. We know who those are. We know that out of this same higher criticism of the Bible produced Nietzsche, produced Marx, Moses Hess, Engels, all of these people, Jewish and Gentile, rose up. But in Germany, these people like Nietzsche developed ideas based on Darwinism, which led directly to the militarism of Germany, Kaiser Wilhelm, that preceded the First World War. The Marms building, the might is right, the Superman type of mentality came directly out of this denial of the God of the Bible, instead going for the survival of the fittest. The fittest military dictatorship in Europe should rule Europe. That's behind Kaiser Wilhelm's thinking. And what John is saying here is that unrestrained by any conception of a God of judgment and a God of right and wrong, these humanistic philosophers led the German people especially into leading an arms race in Europe, resulting in the terrible carnage of World War I. We're talking about World War I. That's a full century ago. They used technologies of war unknown to you, Charles, shedding more innocent blood in one century than all previous centuries combined. They incinerated hundreds of thousands of non-combatant citizens with firebombs dropped from the air. They murdered millions who got in their way. Incidentally, these warmongers and brutes called themselves Darwinians. Beware of any movement on the right. Let's not even talk about Marxism. You know very well that Karl Marx rejoiced when he first read The Origin of Species. He says, this has made my whole case. Man is an animal. Man is an economic animal and can be programmed accordingly. But the German Reich was thoroughly evolutionary in their thinking. And we have elements in the right, in the far right in America, that are evolutionary in their thinking. David Duke has expressed an evolutionary point of view. And others, neo-Nazis, are evolutionary, as was Hitler. And that's a bad combination. Because when you have an evolutionary point of view, you begin to regard some races as more advanced in the evolutionary odyssey than other races. And that creates tremendous potentialities for bigotry and even violence. We're seeing that today, of course, in the Middle East with Israel, as these racist Orthodox rabbis are now proclaiming the Palestinians and all the Goyim, the Gentiles, to be merely donkeys, to be at the service of the holy people, the Jews. They murdered millions who got in their way. These people, John says, were not ignorant believers. They held your own philosophical conclusions. By dismissing the Bible as a metaphor, mankind gave himself permission to do what he does best, inflict cruelty far beyond the natural hazards of a fallen world. There's a great limit to the cruelty that a coyote can perform on a sheep. And coyotes are pretty mean. One coyote will grab a ewe's mouth, her nose, hang on tight, and the other one will grab the udder. And they'll pull from both directions, tearing her apart. Well, that's pretty bad. But they haven't killed 15 million baby lambs in America yet, before they were born. Mankind has the potential of vastly greater and mechanized genocide.
It's 52 million.
Is it?
And torture.
Is it really a damnable doctrine, John asked Charles, that such evil men, living by your conclusions, should be punished forever? I don't think it's a damnable doctrine, like Darwin says. Darwin says the whole idea of hell is a damnable doctrine, originating in darkened religions like Christianity, but there's got to be a hell certainly for the wicked, especially for the exponentially wicked, like the Stalins and others. You said there is no more design in organic beings and their natural selection than in the course of the wind blowing. I am astonished, John says, you completely misunderstand the principle of design. Quite simply, if something works, it's a good design. And it makes far greater sense that design was done by an intelligent designer than by the chance mutations which inevitably degrade organisms rather than advance them. Your metaphor itself was flawed. Even the trade winds in their courses are a good design, making possible our life-giving atmosphere. The fixed laws of nature make possible the workings of this wonderful universe and world in which we live. You conclude that suffering seems to argue against an intelligent first cause. By denying God and our obligation to Him, this premise has justified much, much more suffering. During that, desiring that no one believe Christianity, you discount the many benevolent Christian organizations formed to alleviate suffering. This relief has not been the legacy of Hindus and Buddhists. I'm leaving out Muslims there because there are Muslim charitable organizations. For example, the IHH, who was primarily the Turkish relief organization that launched the flotilla, the Gaza flotilla last spring. They have a worldwide reach of eleemosynary and relief organizations worldwide. But it is true that when you get into India and you get into the Far East, the attitude of the pantheistic religions of the East, such as Hinduism and Buddhism, is very, very disregarding of the value of human life. And I remember an anecdote of a British magistrate or something was on an elephant and going along, and the elephant stepped on a little boy and completely crushed the little boy, and he shouted to the mahout, the driver of the elephant. He said, stop, we need to help him. And the mahout said, no, he's just part of the reincarnation. He doesn't matter. Life is cheap in the Far East. Life is really cheap in the Far East. And how different that is from the compassion that has manifested itself through Christianity in the West. And the argument of the Christian to the evolutionist is that there's something here in man, in the conscience of man, that cannot be explained by natural selection. A conscience, aware self-awareness, awareness of the future, all of these things are marks of the fact that we're made in the image of God, not in the image of an ape. Yes?
Morality itself makes me wonder about evolution, because honestly, it gets in the way. I mean, as far as survival goes, it makes more sense to be able to fight your way to the top without having any qualms about killing someone next to you, about hurting everyone to get to the top. I mean, that's the way that animals live. Yet when you get to humans, there is in everyone, no matter how much they deny it, at least some sort of reality of right and wrong. Some sense of there is a universal sense of right and wrong, no matter how much you try to say there isn't.
Yes.
And it doesn't facilitate the evolutionary model because it gets in the way. And so why would evolution have evolved in such a way that would hinder some processes?
Well, another feature which is undeniable in the human species is our religious instinct.
Mm-hmm.
You don't find a religious instinct in any animal. And it is true that God, for His glory, has given the great apes uncanny abilities at memory and decision making and even innovation and so on. And God be the glory that they're taking these chimpanzees and baboons and monkeys and teaching them all kinds of language and words and so on. All that is just, it just, it says that God has wonderfully endowed all of his creatures. And ever since I've been a kid, I have, before it was illegal to do this kind of thing, I would get little birds out of their nests, crows, magpies, hawks, robins, and even a blue jay. We had a blue jay by the name of Jasper, which is the smartest little guy you ever seen. He fell out of a tree, and my brother John brought him to me in a bag. Here was little Jasper, fell out of a tree, and he knew that his days were numbered, but he knew that he had a friend in me. And I started feeding him mashed potatoes and egg mixed together, and he was so appreciative. He totally imprinted on me. I became his mother, and we raised Jasper for a summer, and you cannot believe the intelligence of that little Steller's blue jay. And it was a glory to God that God didn't just make this bird a robot, an automaton, a bug eater in the trees. But he gave him all of these wonderful nuances of intelligence and instinct. I mean, I could go on and on about all the things I learned from Jasper about these subtleties of creation. Anyway, the great apes are in the same category. If you raised one of the great apes from infancy, you would love the little thing because he would be so human, have so many human characteristics, be so endearing in many ways. So what we find is that nature is wonderfully endowed. And the more nature is studied, the more richnesses of behavior are revealed. But nobody has yet found the religious instinct in even the greatest of the apes. Yes.
I just think we should acknowledge our awareness of what the evolutionists are saying in response to this, to Verity's argument, because there's been just, this is the new, latest craze of evolutionists, is to explain what the human instinct for morality as a genetic, with a genetic source, and that love has a genetic source. Everything has a genetic source, and they're trying to pinpoint the gene that exactly creates these impulses, and yet it's contains a self-contradiction, because very few evolutionary scientists will acknowledge that what they're basically saying is there's no real way you can objectively condemn genocide, systematic rape in the Congo, what's happening in Rwanda. You can't objectively say that's bad and it's good to preserve life. Because really, it's just a gene. It's just a synapse firing in your head.
Yes.
But they don't want to admit that. They want to say, well, it does all boil down to biology. But at the same time, we all know that biology is right. And these things really are ultimately right and wrong. And you can't, those two things can't exist together.
Sure.
Either there is an absolute lawgiver and there is an absolute law so that we all naturally agree this is right and this is wrong. Absolutely. Or it does come down to genes and biology, in which case we have no right to have the United Nations or have war crimes trials or have tribunals or even have a criminal system. Mm-hmm. Because really, everybody's just acting on what their biology tells them to do. Yeah, and one's biology is more right than anyone else's.
That's right. Well, there are some birds, of course, that will kill their young if it's a lean year and there's not enough not enough food to raise three young, the parents will actually kill the babies, or they'll allow the babies to kill themselves off and let the strongest ones survive. And of course, the argument is there, well, if the birds do it, the animals do it out of necessity and economic hard times, why not go out and get an abortion yourself? Because that's the law of nature, the law of tooth and fang, and that's it's natural. It's
but
natural.
At the same time, we have to lie to ourselves and say, that's a mass, that's a fetus, that's not a baby.
Yes.
And if you actually take that baby outside the womb and cut its neck and take its limbs off, you're a murderer, and that's wrong, because we know that's wrong.
Sure.
And it's impossible for us to say, I would defy an evolutionist to say yeah, I believe it's genetic. And so really, I would watch someone do that to their kid, because it's just my brain is just lying to me, telling me that that's wrong. It's not really ultimately wrong. It's just my genes. No, we cannot do that. It's deep in our hearts. We know that it's wrong. It's just wrong. And denying that there is some kind of objective truth beyond that is not coherent.
Well, you know, you say we know, but the ability of the liberal world federalist type of mentality to brainwash people and program them is very, very strong. Mm-hmm. For example, back when John and I were in college, our roommate had a brother who was a medical doctor, and he came from the Plymouth Brethren Church, out of a very fundamentalist, old world pietistic denomination. And this young doctor with his beautiful wife came out and took us skiing. Well, it happened that as a Christian, he felt that he had a moral obligation to keep the population of the world down. He, as a medical doctor, devoted his whole life to killing babies. Bright, radiant, witty, handsome, ambitious, prosperous. They came as if his hands were literally bloody, dripping with the blood of thousands of little babies that he had killed. And yet he had no qualms, because he thought he was doing God a service to keep the population of the world down through abortion. Mm-hmm. That just shows how even people, young people in the church, can be absolutely depraved mm-hmm. by this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so John says, you may argue that Christianity has been responsible for many wars, but human political systems of religion do not represent the true nature of God. If we want the true nature of God, we go straight to Jesus Christ, don't we?
Yes.
You get the original, simple, self-denying, loving, compassionate, merciful. That is not the record of the Roman Catholic Church during the Inquisition, is it? It's not the record of many other forms of religion. Don't blame Jesus. Don't blame Christianity for what Torquemada did in Spain in 1490. Okay? As he was pulling people limb from limb and tearing their fingernails out. Man's capacity to be a spiritual image and reflection of God has been usurped by his desire to elevate himself in the survival of the fittest, a concept that true spirituality must repudiate. Like a person who rejects medicine because they once saw a quack doctor, you make the grave mistake, Charles, of missing true value because counterfeits exist. Again, we have a link at truthtellers.org with this article right at the very top. If people would like to review Darwin's arguments, which John is responding to. Your cynicism renders you unable to be led by the Spirit of God. This is a terrible place for a soul capable of knowing the mind of God. I do agree that the hope of heaven gives me less concern about the destruction of our world. This destruction will more than likely be aided by the abuses of humanity, particularly atomic bombs, and in Japan, nuclear fission. The modern technologies of destruction, of which you had no idea, have now rendered the distinct possibility of annihilation, not by the cooling of the sun, but by the wickedness of man. In Japan, we see a frightening symbiosis between terrible natural disruption in a in a great earthquake out to sea, what is it, 80 miles out to sea, a tsunami wave, which are innocent, absolutely innocent in their desire to hurt anybody, and then colliding and interfacing with very potent products of atomic inventiveness by man. We unfortunately have come to a place in history of the world, in the history of the world, where belief in Christ is not impressed on children. Young people leave the church in droves. Evolutionary philosophy is a religion with fervent followers, even among evangelical theistic evolutionists. It is now nearly as hard to shed the inherited belief in Darwinism as to shed the obvious knowledge that the sky is blue. This is your legacy and not one of which to be proud. I have no words to express my contempt for theistic evolutionists. Mm-hmm. They are gutless. They are absolutely without any conception, in my opinion, of giving God Almighty the praise that he deserves. They're all over the place. They fill even the most fundamentalist denominations and Bible schools right now. But I have said before, and I'll even say this, maybe you'd consider it extreme, that there's no creature that scuttles abroad the very bottom of the ocean lower than a theistic evolutionist. Uncharitable? Unkind? No! Theistic evolution flies in the face of the clear record laid down by the will of God in His attention, in His intention to give us information on where we came from as an object of fiat creation of magnificent, stupendous design by the Word of Life, Jesus Christ, in the beginning. And the theistic evolutionist says, I don't really think that it makes much difference where we came from. I heard a theistic evolutionist, a choir leader in a Nazarene church, say those exact words to me. Doesn't make much difference to me. If I need to believe in evolution to get into college and go to graduate school or go to med school or whatever, it's the easiest thing in the world for me to adopt that point of view because it doesn't make much difference. Well, I tell you, you've sold your birthright. And when I first received big lethal doses of evolution at age 15 in biology class, I knew that that had to be fought. I knew that that had to be resisted. I knew that these were big and blasphemous things that they were saying against my God, against my dignity as an erect Homo sapien, to tell me that I had come from some ape or some creature or some slime 6 billion years later, or some catalyst of nutrients in some primordial slough in some period unimaginably far in the past. That was absolutely offensive to me. And I made it a point I was going to fight it, and I did. And John continues, you apologize for lacking the authority to answer abstruse problems. Your resolve to not believe in God contradicts the apologies. It makes your apologies, in other words, empty. You are burning your bridges, Charles, behind you. You have burned them behind you. And this is not the way of a true intellectual philosopher or scientist. We must remain open-minded to the possibilities of reason, science, and the divine. The great philosopher Wittgenstein said that we must always remain most suspicious about what we want to believe. Because what we want to believe seduces our minds and perverts our judgment. Now, there are certain things that we believe because the evidence is overwhelming, absolutely overwhelming. And the evidence for an intelligent, benevolent God of creation is overwhelming. The evidence is overwhelming that we don't go out and drive down the highway and go on the left-hand side of the street. The evidence is overwhelming that we don't take a mountain hike and decide to walk out into empty space. There are certain things that the evidence is overwhelming, and we have to accept those things and believe in them at the same time. But when it comes to theories, philosophies, even religious beliefs, God doesn't hold it against us if we are skeptical about what we are told. And fortunately, the Bible magnificently corroborates itself and confirms its truth, as we're saying here tonight. God rewards those who believe that Nineveh existed. In the time of Huxley and Darwin, they were telling people that there was no writing in the time of Moses, and therefore Moses couldn't have written the books of the Pentateuch. There was no Nineveh, there was no Tower of Babel, there was no on and on and on, and more times than can be enumerated, the scoffers of the late 19th century have been proven wrong. And those people who stayed by God, stayed by the stuff, stayed faithful to Him, have been proven right. That's why even today we are not carried about with diverse and strange and attractive doctrines of the world if they contradict Scripture. We stay by, we know that the foolishness of God is wiser than the wisdom of men, isn't it? We believe in Jonah and the whale. We believe in the flood of Noah covering the whole world. We believe in the Tower of Babel. We believe that Methuselah lived over 900 years because God said so. He was there, we weren't. I have lived, John says, through half a century of innumerable tyrants, philosophers, and imposters who have gained the admiration of the masses. It is foolish to depend on their hollow congratulations to you, Darwin. You hint we may sometimes need to oppose the opinion of others to follow our conscience. Could this conscience be God-given? We can put little trust in the moral sense of an intellect developed only by the law of tooth and fang. I have the advantage of looking in retrospect at the leprosy of skeptical humanism that spread in your time. I am sorry that higher criticism and hypocritical religious institutions seemed to confirm your disbelief. Fortunately, they have been wonderfully countered in my lifetime. I have every reason to continue in faith, and scholars, archaeologists, and scientists are publishing new defenses of God and the Bible every year. As more disbelieve, God reveals even more proofs that are appreciated by those who acknowledge Him. So John concludes, if I may paraphrase Mrs. Barlow, the old lady you mentioned in your article, quote, "Doctor, I know that the creation is wonderfully designed, and I know that my Redeemer liveth. Regards, John Pike." Wasn't that inspiring?
Mrs. Barlow, Nora Barlow was the granddaughter of Darwin, and I'm not quite sure who Mrs. Barlow was, but Darwin quoted her at the very end of his chapter as kind of a concession, and this old lady, Mrs. Barlow, said to Darwin, "Doctor, I know that sugar is sweet, and I know that my Redeemer liveth." So I paraphrased that.
Well, thank you, John. In this fortuitous world, you don't know how close I came to throwing that Darwin article in the trash and going on with researching ADL.
Well, it took me a whole day to write that. I read the Darwin's chapter on religious belief, and I was so mad at him that I had to respond. So I spent the whole day doing it, and it reminds me how important it is that we give Ted and Harmony the freedoms and liberties to do the kind of thinking that they do.
Yeah.
Because it does require intellectual energy and time, and for us working stiffs, it's just very hard to come by that.
Yeah.
But so we very greatly appreciate the work that you are doing, and
it's good to write when your temperature is up, when you're really feeling strong mm-hmm. about something. And John has developed quite a knack for getting his short little paragraphs published in the big Oregonian here. The big Newhouse Oregonian puts up his salty, powerful little epithets against the evil in our time. And lots of Christian people read those. And I just want to encourage members of our listening audience, but students in particular. You know, you have a campus newspaper, and they appreciate you writing in and saying things in defense of the gospel, in defense of Christian morality. We have, in fact, a little video. How long was that video?
45 minutes.
It's called Shaking Campus Liberalism. And we did that many years ago when Harmony was a student at a community college here in our area. And we chronicle how that students began writing powerful articles to the campus newspaper and created a great deal of consternation among the pro-homosexual faculty. And they were an excellent example to many of the Christian students there on campus who never dreamed that they had any obligation to sound off, do anything more than just gather around the maypole in spring, you know, and take their stand around the maypole. Well, we pointed out, and Harmony set the example, that Christians can do a lot more. And thousands of the students would read the Advocate newspaper every other Friday or every Friday when it came out. A tremendous venue and an outlet for truth if we can be creative. So to conclude, I think that this shows the power of not only creative thinking on John's part, but also thought which is spirit-driven, is conscience-driven, which emanates almost like a volcano out of strong anger, strong righteous indignation. And our desire here at Truth Tellers, in all of our writing, all of our videos, all of our radio work, and so on, is to rouse up this righteousness, this groundswell of this anger, righteous anger against the evil that is so predominant in our time. And we absolutely believe, that if enough of God's people, especially in the United States of America, return to Him, return to unite faith with works, faith with action, phoning, writing, calling in to talk radio, speaking out the whole truth, that God in heaven is going to look down and He's saying, I'm not quite ready to let America go under with that much faith in America. I will stay the execution. I will give more time because I like the sound of this praise that's coming in my ears. Amen?
Amen.